Chapter 12. Jay, it's Quincy! Open the door, man! Quincy was oblivious to the amount of noise. The hallway behind him was packed with bleary-eyed students, most of whom were dressed for bed. They all shared a look of disgust and a common goal to return to bed, or whatever nighttime pursuits they were engaging in, as quickly as possible. To the casual passerby, it appeared that the cause of the mass exodus into the hallway was Quincy's incessant banging, which was now bordering on panic. The sudden high-pitched scream from the other side of the door, however, told a different story.
"What the hell's going on?" a deep voice boomed out from the far end of the corridor.
Quincy recognized the voice as belonging to Garth Pullman, a good friend and, more importantly, the captain of the rugby team.
"Garth, mate, over here! Something's up with Jay!"
Seemingly unaware of the wall of people in front of him, Garth ploughed his way through them as fast as he could. Not pausing to exchange pleasantries with Quincy, he shoulder-barged the door. The door was no match for Garth, and it caved in on itself. What Quincy saw when he entered the room, he would never forget. Levitating above the bed, writhing and screaming, was Jason.
"They're dead!" shrieked Jason. "They're dead!"
"Jesus Christ," said Garth.
Quincy did not look in Garth's direction. His gaze was fixed on the blood pouring down the bedroom walls. As he stared, the blood faded away.
"I don't think so, mate," he said quietly.
Why am I risking my career on a hunch? Luther was minutes away from the university Jason Chen studied at, against the direct orders of Chardon, who had contacted him minutes after the torch jet was airborne. He glanced at the hastily scribbled down directions fastened to the steering wheel with tape, which he had got from a 24-hour garage, along with two microwave egg and sausage rolls, the remnants of which were sitting on the passenger seat. Chardon's orders could not have been clearer. He was to return to headquarters for debriefing and reassignment. Luther explained Catherine's belief that Jason Chen was in danger. He remembered suppressing his anger as Chardon described Catherine as an unstable former agent who should never have been brought into the investigation in the first place. Chardon warned Luther that he was overstepping the bounds of his authority, and the resources of the agency were not there to indulge his whims. Luther thought it best not to mention that there were two agents conducting an investigation he should have been handling alone. Bending the rules was one thing, but this was trampling them underfoot. This was the first time since joining Torch he had disobeyed a direct order, despite having a flair for it when he worked for MI6. Sometimes he wondered how he managed to keep that job for as long as he did. It was his zeal and dedication to Queen and country and all the other tired clichés that landed him in more trouble than he could ever have planned for. He believed back then that no one was above the law. God, he thought as he pulled onto the school grounds, I could not have been more wrong. Jason allowed his mind to wander as he waited in the office. Since the episode in his bedroom, the police had delivered the news of his parents' murder. When the dean, along with two police officers, came to tell him, he simply replied, "I know," before anyone said a word, and then lapsed into silence. Both Quincy and Garth were led away for questioning. Jason saw the fear in their eyes as they left. Fear of him. There were no tears, no feelings of sadness or words left unsaid. Just an unshakable sense of inevitability. Jason knew no one else would understand because he did not understand. The moment the Carsons entered his life, something told Jason this day would come. He liked the Carsons in his own way, but there was never any real love between them, well, at least not from him. They were nothing like Tony and Jin Chen, the young couple who adopted him soon after his abandonment at the hospital. Jason could not have wished for better parents than the Chens, adoptive or otherwise. In a sane world, they would have been his biological parents. They would never have left him to the mercy of an adoption system that, with all its safeguards and checks, was still an emotional lottery. When Jason was old enough, the Chens told him about the events surrounding his adoption. They believed he deserved to know the truth about his origins. It was a hard truth for Jason to accept, but the Chens were there to support him every step of the way. It was the Chens who had honored the wish written on the note found when he was born, asking him to be named Jason. The Chens had died in a traffic accident 10 years ago. Their deaths hit Jason hard, and even now he still mourned their passing. Perhaps this was why he never formed any real emotional connection with his new parents. Although John and Mary Carson were more concerned with themselves and their place in the world, he would still miss them. He would not, however, miss the secrets, the whispered and sometimes angry conversations between them and the strangers who would sometimes visit the house. These clandestine meetings would end if Jason entered the room. Whenever he broached the subject with his parents, he was met with excuses, silence, or was politely told to mind his own business. By the time he left for university, he was long past caring. They could keep their secrets so long as they kept signing the checks for his tuition fees. Only once did Jason catch a glimpse beneath the surface of his father. He had been going through one of his dad's drawers, searching for a law book he promised to let Jason have for his studies. Instead of a volume on consumer law, Jason was shocked to find a gun. His father entered just as Jason was lifting the gun from its hiding place. His dad's usual indifferent and distant demeanor shattered. He flew across the room at Jason, grabbed his arms, and shoved him against the wall. Jason froze. His dad was far stronger than he imagined, and Jason doubted he could have broken free. He felt the gun torn from his grip as his father warned him to stay out of his affairs. Luckily for Jason, his mother came running into the room and was able to pry his father away. As he made a swift exit, Jason overheard his father whisper to his wife.
"He doesn't know we're doing this all for him."
"Are you, John?"
Jason heard his mother reply.
"Of course I am. Don't ever doubt it."
Jason saw his father look at the gun and smile sadly. Like this is going to make any difference if they find us. There was definitely more to his father's actions that night than just anger at a disobedient child, especially when he never expressed any strong feelings towards Jason, unless apathy counted for anything. Days later, he was packed off to university and no more was said about the incident, and until now, Jason had never given it any more thought. The office door opened and Jason saw Bob Hunter, the student counselor, entered the room.
Student counselor? Now there was a paradox, thought Jason. How does a man twice divorced and a none-too-secretive alcoholic operate under the misguided belief he can spout out advice like a greeting card?
Bob walked over to a large wooden cabinet behind his desk. He opened it and took a half-full bottle of whiskey in one hand and two coffee mugs held dangling by their handles in the other. Smiling his thanks at him, Jason took the mug of whiskey. He watched Bob fill his own mug before pulling his large armchair round to face him. Bob's shaggy long hair and bleary, bloodshot eyes gave him the look of a man two steps away from living rough.
"Late night," said Bob. "I've got a ton of papers to be marked by the end of the week. Guess it's finally beginning to show."
Jason nodded in agreement, failing to add the comment that Bob always looked like something the cat had dragged in, then, after smelling the alcohol and stale nicotine, dragged him back out. Bob pointed at Jason's mug whilst taking a sip from his own.
"You look like you could use that."
"You read my mind," said Jason, forcing a smile. Not needing any more encouragement, Jason cupped the mug in both hands and took a drink. His body shuddered as the whiskey forcibly introduced itself into his bloodstream.
"I take it the police have finished with you for the night," said Bob.
Jason began shifting nervously in his chair. He was no more ready to deal with the night's events than he was 2 hours ago.
"I'll be back tomorrow."
He lifted the mug for a second drink, this time steeling himself for the burning side effects. Jason noticed Bob's eyes soften and knew he was about to launch into his professional, "I understand what you're going through," attitude. He weighed up the pros and cons of trying to make a quick exit. He was going to have a hard enough time once the lectures started and the gossip began. His original plan for the weekend would have placed him at home yesterday and he would have been killed with his parents. It was something he had yet to work through. At least if he left now, he could try and grab a few hours' sleep, if possible, and maybe clear his head a little.
"Listen, Jason, no one's going to force you to talk, certainly not me."
Too late. The first caring salvo had been fired. There was no escape for him now. Luther pulled up alongside the security window and saw a pair of boots propped up on the ledge. He rolled down his window and waited for a few seconds, then coughed to try and attract some attention.
"What?"
came a gruff reply. "I'm here to see Mr. Hunter, I believe..."
"Name?"
Luther had not disobeyed orders, flown across the channel and driven non-stop to suffer fools gladly. He tossed his identification badge through the open window.
"Oh, Christ," came a much more subdued voice. "You're with Torch."
"Now, Mr. Size 9, I've been told a Mr. Hunter is with a student whose life may be in danger. So unless you want to find yourself on the wrong end of a charge of obstructing a Torch-sanctioned investigation, I suggest you open this gate and tell me where I can find Hunter." A thin young man in a dark blue security uniform appeared at the window, hastily stubbing out his cigarette on the desk in front of him. In his shaking left hand, he held Luther's ID.
Shit. Sorry, mate. I mean, Agent Washington, he blurted out. Didn't mean to... Well, you know...
Luther grinned, suddenly remembering Nelson. No harm done. Just get the gate open and point me in Hunter's direction.
That's the weird thing, sir, said the guard as he pressed the button to open the gates. You won't find Mr. Hunter in his office.
Why not?
Shouldn't really say, but I've seen him most nights this week passed out in his car. Reckon he keeps a load of booze in there, said the guard. I heard he didn't get the pay rise he'd been after. Poor sod's been a wreck ever since. Funny thing is, he's usually stumbling back into his office by now, but he's not moved for hours.
Luther loosened his pistol from its holster and then swung open the passenger side door. Get in.
You what?
Now! The guard ran out of the booth and jumped in. The car screeched through the gate where it sped down the road, veering left at the roundabout and skidding onto the main car park.
Show me where!
Over there, said the guard, pointing.
The last one on the right.
Luther pulled the car into a tight turn to bring it alongside the battered dark blue Ford Escort. He drew his gun, threw the door open and leapt out. Peering into the car, he saw sprawled across the back seat the naked body of a man with his throat torn out.
Is that him?
The guard nodded, his hand covering his mouth.
Where's his office?
The guard was silent, his eyes still on the corpse. Luther slammed him against the car door.
Where?
The guard pointed to a large building in front of them.
Main building, third floor, A302. Call the police,
ordered Luther, sprinting towards the main building. Bob leant forward in his armchair, displaying a willingness to listen. Jason tried to figure out what textbook Bob had gathered his tactics from. Whatever book it was, subtlety was obviously a chapter Bob missed.
If you keep everything bottled up, it'll only come back to haunt you in the long run, said Bob. But then you're not stupid, you already know that.
Jason said nothing at first, only the constant, almost hypnotic thudding sound from the rain steadily falling outside pervaded the silence. I see it all.
Go on,
said Bob, his voice still keeping its reassuring tone. It was so real. I looked through its eyes like I was there, like I was doing it, everything. It ripped them apart.
Ripped who apart, Jason?
The bodyguards, my parents. It tore them to pieces like they were nothing. Then it laughed. It just laughed. Jason's face was drained of colour, expressionless. I know I was dreaming or something, but I couldn't wake up. Then I heard the voice telling me to wake and remember.
Voice? What voice?
Jason looked at Bob. He was looking even worse than earlier. He was sweating and seemed to be having trouble breathing. You okay, Bob? He said, genuinely concerned. Genuinely concerned. Should I call the campus nurse?
No, said Bob, dabbing his brow with a grey handkerchief. I'm fine, go on. You were saying about hearing a voice.
Something was wrong. Jason had already explained the disembodied voice to Bob. He'd gone to see him straight after the incident in the lecture theatre. It was a man's voice and it's not my own.
This voice, does it have a name?
Bob's manner was no longer full of reassurance, but sounded more like panic. Gray, Jason told him. Joshua Gray.
And what did this Gray tell you?
I can't remember.
You're lying!
Bob hurled his mug of whiskey against the far wall. It broke into three pieces, staining the wall with alcohol. Bob's behaviour was registering a high on Jason's weird shitometer. He had no idea what was wrong with Bob, but he was not waiting around for the encore performance. Jason was halfway out of his seat when he was forced back into it by Bob. Jason struggled, but could not break free of the hand clamped on his shoulder. Bob was far stronger than his frail frame implied.
You must come with me, Jason, said Bob, sweat pouring down his face.
Jason did not understand what was going on. This was not the Bob Hunter he knew.
Why? I have no choice. The Cabal's will must and will be done.
Bob's hand snaked out. Seizing Jason by the throat, he lifted him out of the chair. Jason clung onto Bob's wrist with both hands, his legs lashed out in all directions, trying to strike his would-be kidnapper. Desperate to free himself, he sank his teeth into Bob's hand. The skin felt strange between his clenched teeth, like bitter-tasting dough, soft and spongy. Jason yanked his head backwards, tearing off a strip of skin in the process, only to find Bob's grip still as powerful. Jason thought he was going mad when he looked at the wound. The skin he had torn from Bob's hand was merely a covering. Beneath it was a dark reptilian-like skin.
"Struggle all you want, boy. Like me, you will come to know your true place on this earth." Bob smiled, baring all his teeth. "Who is this Joshua Gray? What has he told you?"
Jason stared, horrified, as several of Bob's teeth began to elongate until they became black fangs. He was splattered with a foul-smelling and sticky yellow substance as Bob's tongue split down the middle.
"Last chance, boy," rasped the creature Bob was fast becoming. "What did Gray tell you?"
"Are you going to kill me?" Bob flexed the fingers of his right hand. The skin began to crack and peel away like dead leaves, revealing a scaled hand. His fingernails fell out to be replaced by talons.
"Kill you," laughed Bob. "You are far more important than you realize. They tell me I must bring you alive, but they did not say how much alive."